Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Petz, and this is the fourth and final episode in this little short series of catch-up interviews. In this episode, I chat to the author, Raina Wynn. She wrote the best-selling book, The Salt Path, and subsequently, The Wild Silence. Her first book, The Salt Path, was such a beautiful book, so well written, and really quite an extraordinary story of how her and her husband Moth lost their family home in Wales and just didn't quite know what to do with themselves next, so undertook this epic adventure, really, of a 600 odd mile walk along the southwest coast path in England. Knowing her, like all of the other interviewees over these past few episodes, as being somebody who has found so much solace and peace in the natural world, I wondered again how she's coped with being so restricted over the past year, and just to see how she's got on, really. We last spoke back in 2019, although I do incorrectly say at the start of the interview that I think it's about 3 years ago. Turns out it was under 2 years ago, but time has been a fickle beast lately, hasn't it? So we last spoke in 2019, and you can find that episode if you search through the archives, and it's called When the Earth Moves Under Your Feet. Raina's second book, The Wild Silence, is different because it talks about just what happens next. You know, I really find that interesting when you come back from these big experiences and adventures, and then you have to reacclimatize into what we probably would call normal life, and just the adjustment that you have to make going from big to small, which is something we've actually all experienced over this past year. She just did it a little bit earlier than all of us. So I really wanted just to see how she coped. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. I don't know if you remember, but we were at the Wealden Literary Festival, and it was off the back of, you were sort of a veteran of the literary circuit by then, because The Salt Path had come out and it was coming towards the end of a year of promoting it. I think you were just starting to kind of get into maybe thinking about the next book, but and also just into that next phase of your life as well. It was a while ago. It must have been, what, 3 years ago, that, I reckon?
It was quite a while ago.
It was a while, wasn't it? It was boiling hot. I remember that.
Yeah, really hot day, and we sat under the trees, didn't we, by a little lake.
That's right.
It was a lovely day. Such a beautiful little festival.
It's lovely, yeah. And it was really nice because I remember I went there because I was really keen to try and interview you, and I thought, how am I going to find her? And then there was a talk on that I was quite interested in, and I snuck in around the back of the tent instead of going through everybody. I just saw there was this little flap that was open, and I sort of snuck in and then got on a seat. And then I thought, and I was just thinking, I wonder how am I going to find Raina? I wonder how I'm going to manage that. And then sort of moments later, you just appeared through exactly the same way as I'd come in and snuck in through this flat and stepped over and sat down. And I looked over and I was like, oh, hi, great, perfect. There you are.
That's a
lovely
funny,
little moment.
Both sneaking through the flap.
Yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, there's a certain type of person that does that, I think. It's usually to avoid people a bit, isn't it? And it's like, oh, I'm just going to sneak in and I'll sit here and I can get out if I need
right.
to.
Right, it's that certain sort of person. And you meet the strangest people when you're sneaking through flaps. I think it's definitely something to do with being outside makes you sneak through tent flaps.
Doesn't it? I think it makes you a bit more mischievous. Or like you maybe choose the way that isn't the most obvious to everyone else somehow. You see different little openings or something. I don't know.
I think you might be right there. It's maybe that's it. We see doorways where other people don't.
There's definitely pros and cons to that, I think. So yeah, I mean, I guess then, you know, this last year, I mean, your life was so different anyway. You'd already gone through so many changes and so, oh gosh, so much. But then this last year, I mean, lockdown, restrictive, all of the crazy things we've all been experiencing, you know, a fear or all of the emotions, you know, how have you been in that?
Well, it's been strange, hasn't it? I mean, like you said, things have changed so much for me before. You know, we've gone from having that sort of life in a really remote spot in the hills in Wales, then to find ourselves homeless on the path, and then, you know, found accommodation again, and the book was published. It had all been a bit of a whirl over the previous few years. But then the second book was just about to be published early last year. And then we all went into lockdown. Mm. And the book publication got put on hold. And so instead of facing 4 months of what was really going to be virtually back-to-back events, right through those 4 months, it was going to be really, really busy. Suddenly there was nothing. Mm. And because I'd found myself in Cornwall, in a really quite rural spot by then, on a farm, it was almost like I'd gone full circle. We'd gone through that madness of the book publication, suddenly back to that really quiet, quite isolated life that we'd had before life just went to, you know, pear-shaped. So it's been a really strange experience, actually, but quite nice in a way for us.
Right. So does it has it felt like sort of just connecting back into a bit of simplicity again then, without, you know, the wider world? Because your world grew, didn't it? I mean, suddenly you were very much in the world.
Goodness, yeah. Being a person who's really quite withdrawn in a way, quite shy, and certainly not a gregarious person, to finding myself then publicising a book and in book events and talking to complete strangers and sitting on stages, it was a real whirl, because it was so alien to me and alien to the way I'd ever lived before, and I think quite alien to the core of who I am as a person. It's been quite exhausting, really. So suddenly to find that stopped, almost, you know, literally overnight stopped, it was like taking a big deep breath, really.
Okay. It didn't feel as jarring as it was the other way round. It was more settling than jarring. Yeah. Ah, interesting.
Yeah, the isolation was so familiar.
Right.
Thing. I mean, where for so many people it was the absolute opposite, I think for me it was like going back to an earlier time.
And what sort of things have you been? Okay, so you're on a farm now, just to paint a bit of a picture. You walked the path, and then you met that woman on the bench, and you found somewhere to live. But it was quite an adjustment to going back just to living in a building. and it was somewhere quite small, and you know, you couldn't see the horizon every day.
It was really strange, because we'd come to the end of that walk, we were homeless, and then somebody offered us accommodation, and that was absolutely fantastic and the most amazing thing that could have happened, and incredibly generous of the woman that allowed us to live there. And I thought everything would be absolutely fine. I thought it just back into normal life and just pick up another life and carry on. But it really, really wasn't. It wasn't easy for me to adjust to at all. I found out I was really agitated. I couldn't sleep. I even found myself out on the headlands in the middle of the night. Just felt like I was searching for something I'd lost almost.
Right.
It got so bad, I even put the tent up in the bedroom.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like you went through maybe what some people have gone through during this whole last year. You just did it early, like that kind of constricted feeling of, oh, I can't get out, I can't do those things. It's like you went through it maybe just 2 years earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. It was that feeling.
Right.
I think it was probably driven by the fact that I'd always lived such a sort of outdoors life, a very rural life, like I said, quite isolated. It wasn't until we moved into that apartment that I realised I'd never even lived in a village before. So never lived among people, where you walk out the door and there are people there. And it felt incredibly claustrophobic.
Yeah.
As if I couldn't breathe, you know. It was a very strange sensation. And then to find myself in this little flat, after all those months of living wild on the headland, where every morning I opened the tent flap and there was just the sea, and just that endless the sea, I felt so constrained, so shut down. So for me, I think that was my lockdown. I had a few years of lockdown.
Do you think that was the slightly as well, the carrying forward of that sense of worrying what people are thinking of you because of the judgment that you two, you and Moth, your husband, received on the path, you know, from losing your home? There's that horrible judgment and assumption that can be made towards people who have become homeless. And then you get so sensitive, don't you, to what you think people are thinking of you, or defensive almost. So then to be put in, you know, to be in a village where suddenly you're surrounded by people, do you think it was kind of even more intense because you were carrying some of that forward with you?
Oh, sure it was.
Yeah.
Because when we were walking, so many people reacted so badly to finding homeless. You know, often, you know, people saying, you know, how come you got so much time to be walking so far? And when we said, because we've lost our home, it was strange to find that people almost physically recoiled. Yeah. And worse, far worse in some occasions. So that really sort of destroyed our trust in people. That sort of immediate open trust of the stranger that most of us have, it was gone, and we became very, very wary of interacting with people, and even changed our story to avoid that scenario. So I think when I came into the village, you're right, I was carrying a sort of sense of that, a sense of I'm going to receive that same reaction, and now I can't walk away. So maybe I was avoiding even having a conversation with anybody in case that point came up of, where were you before? Why are you here?
Right.
I would have had to have explained myself. So maybe a year passed and I realised I hadn't said more than hello to anybody other than Moth. You know, I'd meet people in the street, I'd say hello and that would be it. Or in the, you know, I might say hello, goodbye. I was really, really sort of withdrawing into myself because of that. That sense of who I was so tied up with countryside, with open space, with that sense of security and safety that you draw from what you regard as home. I think I took that from the natural world, and even more so in those months spent homeless on those headlands, that had become our safe place, just there on that path, the countryside, the rhythms of the day, the rhythms of the weather. That had become our safe place and that secure thing that couldn't change, that couldn't be taken away. And then suddenly it was taken away. Like some people, I think, over the last few months, there's a real sense of loss, and of not just loss of losing something, but losing yourself as well.
Yeah, very much so. You know, the things that you feel like make you you, and then they're taken, well, I guess they are taken away. I think it's just so many people have lost their footing. It's just taken a minute to kind of re-find something else that will help. Yeah, it's a real sense of grief and loss, I think, or potentially could still yet be unprocessed because we're all clinging on, waiting for it to be over.
Yeah, I think we're all so desperate for it to be over and think that we'll just go back into normality. But I think for many people, it's not going to be an easy transition.
No, not at all.
I went into that apartment and I really needed something. I needed something to reconnect me almost to my own life.
Yeah.
And as I said, it was nearly a year had passed in this sort of no man's land of living. And I think it was then that I started to write this old path. And I was writing it for Moth because he was starting to forget things about that walk. And I just wanted to capture the memory of it for him. But as I started to write it, and I was going back through the guidebook, I could almost smell the salt air. I think I put myself back on the path, and I put myself back into those moments and those encounters and that environment in my head.
Yeah. And
I think that almost saved me from that sense of withdrawal that was getting deeper and deeper by the day.
Yeah.
It gave me back what were actually tangibly, physically being on the path had given me, that real sense of strength that I drew from nature, I think.
Yeah, and you realize it's inside you. It isn't all external, like that resource is, you've met, you know, it's been such a strong feeling that it is actually inside you and you can access it when you need to. And that can be, it's quite a relief, isn't it, when you feel like you're not grasping outside of yourself quite so much.
Yeah, when you're not constantly searching for something that's got to come externally, but,
yeah.
but you actually have it within you anyway, then then it's a very calming sensation to know that that can't be taken away.
And I'm sure at no point during that did you think, oh, this will serve me well for a pandemic.
Oh, no. Strangely enough, it's been crossed my mind.
And so now you're on a farm. And again, that was quite an extraordinary way that you ended up there. It was just a message on Twitter of somebody reaching out and saying, oh, I've got this land and it's very tired and overused and over-chemicaled, and will you help me?
I know. It's just almost unbelievable how it happened.
Yeah.
It was the publisher's fault, really, because they made social media, which I had no idea what I was doing at all, because I'd never even looked at it, never mind taking part in it. So I signed up for Twitter, and someone asked me for my phone number, so I just gave them it.
Oh, wow.
A complete stranger called me and said that, as you said, that he got a historic cider farm that had been really agriculturally overused, but he'd read the Salt Path and thought that we were the people to help him fulfill his dream, really, of putting the biodiversity and the wildlife back into this overused, tired, neglected farm. And we absolutely didn't know what to say, because it was everything that we wanted, you know, just to be able to live our lives back out in the natural environment, to be that sense of freedom that comes with that. And also what it was doing for Moth's health, for being out in the environment, physically active every day, his health had improved.
Just for those that don't know, just in case, he's got a brain
neurodegenerative disease. Yeah. And his health had improved when we were walking on the coast path in ways that we'd been told were impossible. But then after the path, he started doing a degree. Well, studying meant a lot more sedentary time, and his health deteriorated really quickly. So we knew at that point that we really needed to do something physical and back outside, and really soon. And then this offer came at that point, and we knew it was what we wanted, it was what we needed. But we just couldn't bring ourselves to say yes, because of that loss of trust, that loss, just simply being able to allow yourself to trust other people. And it took us months to actually decide to say yes and take the risk, and a huge leap of faith, I think, that it took to jump over that hurdle of mistrust. And
massive. Yeah, and also I guess just that strange feeling of having read your book, and then it seeming like gazillions of people now feeling like they know you as well, and you're like, I have no idea who this is, but on their side it's this sense of, oh well, I definitely trust them because I've read this book, and that sort of strange sense of intimacy or familiarity coming. It's very one-sided, isn't it? It's like, you don't know who all these people are. It must be very odd, that feeling.
Very strange when this complete stranger said, I've just read your book and it felt like a 300-page CV. It's very, very odd. But then I meet people in the street and they think, you know, they know me. And I suppose in a lot of ways they actually do.
Right.
Because I wrote that book for Moths, so there was nothing held back. I wasn't holding any of myself back, because there was no reason to, because it was only for him and he knew it anyway. They're bound to feel as if they know me. And like I say, on so many levels, I think they probably do. In fact, probably know a lot more about me than they should. I certainly shouldn't have included so much about my bowel habits, that's for sure.
But that's the stuff you want to know about those long distance walks. It's like, that's what doesn't get talked about enough, I don't think. So yeah, I was very happy to read about them, Raina. You're still on that farm, you said yes, and how long, it's in Cornwall, and how long have you been there for now?
Now it's been about 2.5-3 years.
Right.
I can't believe where the time's gone, actually, and mainly a year of it, we've been here and hardly left. So I do feel quite attached to the place now because it's been my four walls, really. But in a way, that's been really good because we've started to get to know the place in a far more intimate way because we've been here and we've seen it at its worst when there's hardly any wildlife here, hardly any birds. There were a couple of sparrows and a crow, and that was about it. No, certainly hardly any insect life. And then over this short period of time since we've been here, we've cleared away all the agricultural waste and the pollution of the land and just allowed the land to breathe and stopped the heavy use of fertilizers and herbicides. And just in that short period of time, it's as if the land is starting to heal itself.
Yeah.
And it's really been about what we've done. It's been about what we haven't done. And it's finding its own way back, I think. So just this last year of being here and just observing, really, it's been fantastic to see that there are now just clouds of insects, clouds of butterflies hatching in the spring.
Wow.
Incredible numbers of birds that have become quite rare and deer and all manner of wildlife starting to find its way back. And just in the last few months, the barn owl has moved into the barn.
Oh, wow.
It's been remarkable to just sit and observe it this year, actually. So I've been very, very lucky to be in a position to do that.
Yeah, it must feel very special knowing that you've been part of allowing those things to come back. I just can imagine a great sense of, I guess, pride or well-being or... Those things did so much for you on the path, like watching the birds and the connection, to be able to then be the person who's kind of in charge of this patch of land and allow those things to come to you, almost like you went to them. Must feel nice. Yeah.
We took so much and continue to take so much every day. Right. Just
I know, it's horrid. Oh, yeah.
And humans just... We just extract, don't we? We extract all the time. And what we're being left with is something so depleted and so empty. And I think it's hard to express how radical that is, actually, the effect that we're having on the landscape. So to actually be in a position to be able to put something back, to be able to almost to protect a small area and allow it to find its own way back, that feels like a bit of a privilege, actually.
Yeah, definitely. And are you growing food or do you have animals? Is there any sense of it, you know, in the traditional manner, kind of earning its keep for you? Well, or in that way? I mean, or is it literally just sort of letting go and letting it get on with it and you just get to watch?
It's not rewilding in the rewilding sense. It's more, I would say, regenerative.
Okay.
Allowing the farmland to find its own way back to a more, I think you'd probably look at it as more of a pre-war state of farming.
Yeah.
When there was far less input onto the land of the real push that came into farming post-war to produce at all costs, to take from the land as much as possible and not give back.
It's pre-chemical, but, really, as well. It was after the war that the chemicals really came in hard, wasn't it?
By the governments and the big corporations to produce food after the war, and then that never stopped. We kept producing because then our population has exploded and we've had to feed people. But it's been at such a high cost to the environment and to the biodiversity of the land. It's been at a cost that's too high to carry on paying.
It's just how we do it on a bigger scale now, isn't it? And
it's how to carry on feeding ourselves.
Yes.
And yet still allow wildlife and biodiversity to have its place, because without that, the time will come when we can't feed ourselves anyway, when we've lost all our pollinators and the soil has become so depleted that it won't produce without chemicals. Then we'll be in a real bad place, and we're at that tipping point now, I think, where we've got to acknowledge that and try to take steps away from it before we do go over the edge.
So are you finding your life going kind of almost more in that direction? Kind of, I can see you being on a panel talking about regenerative agriculture now and kind of going off in that direction. Almost.
It's always been a passion. I've got to say, it's always been a passion. Our land in Wales, we always managed it in a very biodiverse way. So to come back here to the land and to have a chance to allow that to happen here. Like I say, feels like a privilege. I don't in any way say I'm any sort of expert, but I can see what happens when you allow the earth to breathe a bit. It can recover. But I think in a way it sort of like correlates with Moth's health when we were walking. You know, we'd been told that his health could not improve, that he was on a downward spiral of ill health to a very rapid decline into the end. But then as we were walking on that path and we were living such a almost primitive life, really, because we were very limited food because we had no money, and outside in the natural environment 24 hours a day. And his health started to improve. His strength came back. His coordination came back. His thinking was clearer. Things that we'd been told were absolutely impossible because it was a one-way street. And then again here on the farm, for him to be out in the environment every day, just active outside, his health's improved again. But it's like a mirror, really, because the land, it's recovering when we've taken away the human input, so just allowing it to be its natural state. Put Moth into his natural state and his health started to improve.
Yeah,
I think there's a big lesson there.
Definitely, it's a symbiotic relationship. We shouldn't ever think of ourselves as separate from nature and the landscape. We're of it and part of it, and we need it for our sustenance. And I think it probably needs us less, but I think we can definitely help it. As much as it sounds like you've had quite a nice time, really, over the last or enjoyed the pause, maybe, you know, I'm sure that
we've been away from family and friends, that older members of the family that we haven't seen for over a year now. So really difficult in that respect. But at least we haven't been confined in the way so many people have. But not out either, because we haven't been able to get out into the wider world. We haven't been able to walk long distances or just explore. And just like everybody else, that's been restricted. We've been.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, have you felt a big hankering to be able to get out and do that again? And
I think we all don't we?
Yeah, I know.
Thing we want to do. And I think we've all been in that position. But also, you know, there's my rucksack's just sitting by the door waiting.
Is it? Yeah, like a patient sort of Labrador. And have you got anything planned?
Well, we have. We've got another big walk planned.
Ooh.
As soon as we're allowed to go and do what we would like to do, the rucksack will be out the door.
Yeah. Can you say any more about it, or is it?
It's quite a long walk.
Okay.
So I'll be putting pictures on social media as we go.
Oh, lovely, brilliant. And is it fairly imminent if everything goes as hoped?
Hopefully, fingers crossed. Yeah. A few weeks.
But. I suppose, I mean, it feels like a lot of your experiences have forced you to be just more present anyway, and to look at the micro as opposed to the macro, and enjoy those small moments, because they're just as precious as like the big grand ones that we can have as well, right?
Yeah, I think they're more important, actually, because they're so every day. And I think when you put your life down to those micro moments, you really do live in that moment, and you take so much more from it then. Really, you really do. I think just to have sat here through last spring and watched woodpeckers just coming and going from the tree by the house, and then for them to watch them the fledglings come out of their nest and all just sit on a wall in front of the house. These tiny little woodpeckers sitting on the wall. Those moments are just possibly even more important than those big macro moments of that incredible view in that incredible environment.
Mm.
Or just spending really, really long periods of time just drinking tea with moth and just talking about, you know, the small things of life.
Mm.
They've become so, so important. And I think they are the important bits of life. They're the bits that carry you through. And the big things are just like the punctuation points. Yeah, it's really easy not to live the bulk of your life and just look for those punctuation points. But I think when you're living the micro moments, as we've all been forced to do, I think life's so much richer because there's so much more to it.
And there seems to be the difference between seeking and receiving. And I think sometimes we just need to sit back and receive, actually, and pay attention to what's already there instead of seeking the next thing all the time. Although there's probably a little bit of a blend of both needed, but I think we can miss out on the receiving of moments over the seeking of them.
Oh, you're so right.
You
can. Yeah.
There we go. That was Raina Wynne. Her books, The Salt Path and The Wild Silence, are both widely available, and nobody needs to use Amazon to order them, right? Ever, right? Many, many, many other platforms available. Thank you so much for listening to this little series. It's been so nice to be back and to interact with some of you again and read your comments and see your comments, and it's been a real pleasure. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can email growingwildreverb@gmail.com or on Instagram, which is growingwild@growingwildfm. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with this next. I don't know, but as soon as I do, I'll let you know. But until that time, with life tentatively opening up again, I hope that you've got some good adventures planned and some experiences to light up your spirit and get back out there. I'd love to know what you get up to. Let me know, tag me, give me a shout. I like the interaction. If you feel like you can support the show, then please do. It's www.kofi.com, and that is KO-FI. There's nothing like having to spell out a website. Brilliant. www.kofi.com/growingwild, and you can follow the instructions from there. It really helps. It helps me to enable to continue to make the show. I know it's always a bit of a pain in the butt when we ask you for this stuff, and it feels kind of punky to ask, but it really does help. So thank you to everyone that has already, actually, and it's super helpful. So until the next time, whenever that may be, I wish you all the love. Go well. Take care. See you soon.